Thank you. Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. I, again, appreciate your responses, kind words, and questions. I want to spend just a little bit more time directly answering some of the questions that you've sent in rather than working them into the discussion. And I'll get to our lecture mode and what we're supposed to be talking about in just a few minutes. But I want to highlight two or three of the questions that I saw again and again, and I want to synthesize a response that I hope will be practical for you. One is how to help people remain confident in their abilities and strengths. Another, are there some brains better wired for change than others? Or do we start at the same baseline? And is it a muscle you can develop? Another, how can I effectively guide myself and support my clients through the emotional, psychological, and behavioral stages of transition and change to become a catalyst for growth? Let me try to respond from the perspective of a mentor coach to these are excellent questions. So one way of thinking about this as a coach is that we are approaching each coaching session, helping the client develop a model of what they can use with us actively as well as what they can take away and use when we're nowhere on the horizon. So what we do is to ask the client to focus on one specific aspect for us to discuss and ask where they'd like to get to with that. That creates a map. A map has two coordinates, where you are, where you want to go. So progressively then, we move together with a collaborative framework. Very important, a collaborative alliance with the client that we're working together with their focus and their destination in mind. And with this map, we can measure progress along the way, and we can tell what's detour and what's distraction. So we're developing this story so that they get to a point and they're developing a model of how to focus on one thing and get to where they want to get to with it. So an assumption that I have, and I think it can be useful for us as coaches, is as we are attuned not just to the content but to the process of what unfolds, a client is, and this is a little bit of a reiteration, a client will show us exactly what it's like to be them. In other words, every algorithm that determines feeling, thinking, behaving will manifest so that we have a chance in vivo to understand that and understand it collaboratively and to develop with that focus the story so that they can get to where they want to go, so that that model is there, downloaded, when they are the next time sitting down at their desk, they'll have that model. Instead of five things and being over, what am I going to focus on? Where do I want to get to with that? So we guide in our role of that collaborative engagement. Now, the framework is possibility, not a problem. So that's the framework that we engage with the client, to look at possibility, to look at what they want to do, what the next step is with that focus and that destination, so that they have that working model and that experience and the sense of effectiveness of being able to successfully approximate where they want to get to it, summarize it in a sentence or so at the end, and create a plan for a commitment. So it moves from a good idea to a plan. And the idea of summarizing has some relevance too, because that completes the circuitry in the brain and makes it more memorable, more retrievable. University of Waterloo did a study, I mentioned this, several thousand participants read the same story, half read it out loud, half read it silently. They were all given a test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. This is a part of the principle of why we want to get the client to summarize in a brief sentence and to make a commitment, because they will stick to what they plan to do much more likely when they put it into words or into writing, because that then becomes part of what they want to live into. And this is the accountability. Fast forward to next week, that's where we began. What did they do with that commitment? The two things they committed to do. If they didn't do them, that's the session for that next, for that present seminar. So that's exactly the client showing us what it's like to be them. They'll have some good ideas, but they don't follow through.
Okay.
I'm sorry, was there a question? Was there a question? Don't hesitate to interrupt me. So this is the idea of listening for any kind of limiting assumptions that someone has, feeling that they need to be confident or need to be comfortable before they can begin. That's a limiting assumption. Comfortable and confident are not a place you begin. It's a place you get to. So these are ideas that we have, that we're helping a client develop a way to create a map and successively approximate fulfilling it within a period of time. If that's a sample session, it's 15 minutes. If it's a coaching session, it's 45 or 50 minutes, and there may be more than one. So these are some of the principles, I think, that we operate on in creating a story with a client. Each session, a story has a beginning, middle, and end. The challenge, the development, the resolution, the focus, the map of where they want to get to, collaboratively pursuing that, and then once arriving, to summarize it and make a commitment based on that. So each coaching session is a story in and of itself, and that's a different way of approaching things than thinking about all the things that could go wrong. And again, the framing is important. We look at possibility rather than problem. The client begins with, well, here's the problem. That's where I would interrupt and say, let's look at the possibility. When you begin a focus on possibility, that creates a mindset that engages in a very different way, in a different neurochemical system, to look at creating something new and different, developing new pathways. If you focus on a problem, you go down an old pathway, and it etches it a little bit further every time, which is why some people get stuck in therapy, because they'll have, you know, all the solutions to the problem, but yet it really doesn't change. So I hope, and again, send me any questions or respond now if there are aspects of this that doesn't make sense. I'd like to follow up and address it, and hope that this offers a kind of an overview, at least, for a number of the questions that I saw that I wanted to address directly rather than just work into the discussion. Any other comments or additions at this point? Well, I'll put us on lecture mode then, so you don't have to worry about the background, and we'll come back and have hopefully have some time at the end for discussion. We're going to talk in this seminar about mindset mapping for growth. Now, remember from last seminar, we talked about a state of mind being like a software program. And we have several states of mind, several software programs. And each software program determines what we perceive, how we process, how we respond. Each state of mind, the same. So mindsets frame an ongoing account of how we perceive, process, and respond. This is why I think it's important for us as coaches to be very grounded, centered, and focused as we begin to engage with a client and how we may need to help them be aware of state of mind and regulate to get grounded and centered, for example, to have access to all of their states of mind rather than being in a particular state and a reactive mode to get grounded and centered to be able to pause, to reflect, and then to have an informed decision. So whenever a new situation arises, a new map is booted up. This explains how we have different contexts or frames for different situations. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology found that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. So basically, our brain works like a Google map. So whenever we see a situation, we boot up a map to respond to it. This is why it's very helpful, two things, to be regulated and to be able to have access to all of our states of mind and to be able to understand a story of how these different mindsets relate and can be synthesized into strategic planning and successful performance. So this is an aspect of what we do as coaches, to listen for this process and how grounded and centered someone is, to be able to, if this is necessary, to help them regulate a state of mind, to be able to consider. And then we can listen for how their thoughts, feelings, beliefs fit with their story, how effective it is. Let me give you an example about how a belief can determine an entire outcome. This is a true story. It happened a number of years ago out of Oxford. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. After a year, the two anthropologists emerged to compare notes, and they expected, and their teams expected, pretty essential similarities, but they found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a real comfort and unity with the apes, a real intimacy. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful, vigilant, watchful, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, and never achieved that relaxed harmony. Well, they and their teams puzzled about this. They puzzled for several months because they couldn't find any. Finally, they found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed, he never used it, the apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. His belief was that if things got tough, he had an out, and he needed an out. So he carried a gun. The anthropologist, who had no gun, instead had a very different belief, a commitment. He knew from the beginning he would make it on his own. So in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. The belief determined the reality. We tell our story, then our story tells us. A belief is a feeling of certainty about what something means. So if you want to get curious about what a client's belief is, well, how do you know that? As coaches, we listen for limiting beliefs, assumptions that don't work, things that ghostwrite behaviors that don't have optimum outcomes. So part of that is effectively getting grounded and centered to be able to boot up a mindset that's applicable and relevant for the task at hand. When you're grounded and centered, you have access to all states of mind and all of the possibilities. So at a macroscopic level, selecting a mental map that's most productive is somebody feels anxious and uncomfortable about trying something, about changing, and we may help them correctly read the anxiety or the uncertainty of this new endeavor, this new step, simply as a validation of moving ahead. Whenever they do something new or different, the brain's error detection mechanism and the discomfort of breaking a script will read as some discomfort. So if this is interpreted as my gut's telling me or my intuition says this is not right, or, you know, I just feel anxious, I'm going to take off on doing this till next Tuesday, this is something we want to help them incorporate. This is part of the collaborative alliance to help them understand their behavior, their thoughts and feelings, and how their mind works while we're looking at what they want to focus on. So here's a microscopic level of that. If you label something wrong, you'll write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. For example, if you feel bad saying no to someone and label the feeling as guilt and decide to accommodate and justify, that label and that map will be different than if you see it as setting an appropriate boundary where no simply means no thank you, I have plans, or I'm taking care of myself, I appreciate the offer. So no doesn't mean guilt. No simply means you're taking care of yourself. Carl Menninger, one of the founders of psychiatry and psychoanalysis, said, save guilt for real sin. Now, here's another example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, I'd like you to be, she was an attorney, I'd like you to be the executor of my estate. And his daughter, my client, said, well, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and your wishes. He said, well, that's none of your business. A little bit of a conflict there. Now, remember, the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are what we construct and how we frame things that we then seek information and determine our choices based on that framework. This is where we began with the client to look at a framework that's new and different to start with, at possibility, instead of the default mode of what they're operating on, or to look at problems, which may be the same. So one thing I want to highlight a little bit more about a part of the brain. This is an actual anatomical part of the brain, the error detection mechanism, because it explains a number of things. In addition to we tend and want to repeat the same thing, to stick with our script, because this is the default mode. The brain designs itself to make things that are repeated automatic, and it makes it easier. It conserves energy. Now, never mind, it may not work as well, or it may be limiting, but it's automatic, and it takes less energy, and it brings closure. So the error detection mechanism, an actual part of the brain, very close to the emotional center, adds to that, because if anything is new or different, and this is the survival mode originally, if anything is new or different, an error from what we expect, it activates, and we notice it. So So this means that we notice something and feel something that we're doing that's new and different. And it doesn't feel, maybe it doesn't feel right, it doesn't feel as easy and automatic because the script is being broken. We notice differences more easily than confirmation. So it's easier to focus on the things we do wrong or the problems, and we struggle to list our strengths. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, it sets off an error detection mechanism, which is one of the reasons that advice, suggestions, even disguised as a multiple choice to a client doesn't work. There are a number of reasons that doesn't work. This is one of them. Also, focus on problems energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. So these mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, maybe stress earlier in childhood or just in a different context, may not apply in a new and different situation. We're beyond the usual models in an unprecedented situation, unprecedented success, dealing with things that we've not dealt with before that are new or different. The common things, like being a parent, dealing with a life-threatening illness, the loss of a loved one, all the way to other uncommon, unprecedented experiences like fame, wealth, power, influence. This is where we're going to be helpful with a client to help them navigate these situations, staying with their own needs, ideals, their identity, but encompassing and considering from a balanced state of mind and a positive framework the things that we'll do with them. So here are some things then. And that's how the error detection mechanism in the brain can be used as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So here are, and this is in your outline, at least the overview, 10 principles of how our brain operates to facilitate change. 1, change generates discomfort. That's exactly what we've been talking about. We resist change partly due to something more challenging than just deciding to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain in a small part just to create a new connection. Activities that we've repeated that become habits are hardwired in the brain. So we're beginning a new pathway, a new set of neural networks. It's just that it registers in the beginning as discomfort and probably as this isn't what I expected from the brain. This is the constant dialectic. Our mind that wants creativity and to be stimulated, to be excited, says, our mind says, let's try something new. And our brain says, no, let's get it right. In other words, let's do the thing that we've been doing all along and just settle down. So think about how you don't have to think about driving the same way to work. After doing it maybe a month or longer, your brain has hardwired that so you can do it automatically without thinking about it. You can listen to a book on Audible. This default mode is energy efficient, because you get to do anything else you want to do besides think about it. Now, if these habits are confronted and have to change, the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. It's like suddenly there's construction. You have to snake your way through a neighborhood. You can't really pay attention to the book. Your brain will rather go back to the old way. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this. That's why our brains want to avoid change. Not thinking ahead that there may be a glass ceiling or this may not work as well, but this is easier for the, it's automatic. It's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change to preserve the default habit. So our brains naturally resist change. And this is to one of the questions about, are some brains better wired for change than others, or do we all start with the same baseline, and is it a muscle that you can develop? I'll go with an imperfect analogy of a muscle that we can develop. We are all hardwired to be hardwired. So any change is going to disrupt it. It breaks the script. Think about, you're in a discussion with somebody and you have an idea of how that person should respond. You know you do. When they don't respond exactly as you would like them to, it's a little bit disruptive because you had a whole planned scenario of where you were going to go and they didn't fit the script. Our brains have the same thing. Ray Kurzweil said, and I heard him say this in a presentation, and it's in his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations that we can perform without thinking about them. Yogi Berra said it way simpler. I like things you don't have to think about. So, again, the second, change creates dissonance. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. This is very related to number one. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, that's when the error detection mechanism reads as if something's off. So since this, let's apply that now. That's applied obviously to change in our clients, doing anything different, responding in a different way, not reacting, but pausing, perhaps, to respond. But consider, this portion of your brain has the job description to recognize and correct errors. So consider the emotional expense. This is your brain talking to you now. of two different things. You tell a lie. The surface story is the constructed lie. Now, your brain knows better. The subliminal story is the recognition of the lie by the error detection mechanism. Then you have to deal with the dissonance. Triple work. Another, debt. Your brain knows the real expense of buying something you can't afford, you have to pay more for it. But your brain also knows this is you know, you get the high from spending. And we're hardwired for that. But then the emotional experience of the dissonance in your brain is the error detection mechanism reading, at some level, you spent what you couldn't afford to buy. Then you have to pay the interest on the debt. Triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news, this neural machinery that we're talking about can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. So we respond to mistakes. This is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response to change itself. That's an important distinction. Now we'll return to this in a few minutes when we talk about mapping change. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. Let me give you an example. I want to tell you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Maybe 3 and 6? Or multiples of 3? Well, consider this. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story, and for us as coaches. sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs two times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up two quarters in a row, the brain likely predicts a third rise will follow. J. Paul Getty said there are three key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you can see how brain prediction of patterns is also a basis of some jokes. Listing two things, then a third non sequitur. Set up, payoff. So our brains automatically impose patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions at times. And this is part of what we can do in a collaborative way with our clients. And remember, we're doing this from a totally neutral position. We're not looking at trying to influence what the outcome will be, but collaborating with the client to look at how they consider things, how they conclude, how they make choices, because this process is something we may need to address too. How do they decide, and what do they consider in making choices? And this is something they'll take with them. Four, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. For example, you're the COO, Chief Operating Officer of a company that determines a policy about employees being on time. So which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements about being on time? Well, the answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show two things. Threats work short term, but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually subtly increases anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. And another way to say that very simply is you get what you focus on. We know that from The Secret. We know that from neuroscience. You get what you focus on. So be sure you're focusing on the right thing. My wife and I did. She gifted me with a 3-day driving course at the BMW Racing School in South Carolina, taught by a professional racer. The very first part of the first skull session we had was, and we were about to do, you know, high speed turns on wet surfaces. And the first thing he said was, look where you're going, not what you want to avoid. If you look at what you want to avoid, you'll hit it every time. So we know this from neuroscience, quantum physics, and practical coaching. We want to help our client look at what they want to focus on. This is a question we began a session with. What would you like us to focus on this session? So the focus and the collaborative framework all combine. So we assume people are going to receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. That's why data, information, facts, none of that really is effective in changing someone's mind. The error detection mechanism reads, well, this isn't right. And being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. Five, motivation is not essential. Another fallacy that can be debunked. This is what we know. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. You will hear from a client, most likely. I hear in Coach to Coach sessions well, I just need to get motivated to exercise. I need to get motivated to eat a better diet. That's not the way it works. I've worked with professional, probably the most challenging people for this principle right here is professional sports coaches. They know what everybody on that field or that stadium or that court need to do. And when they tell them exactly what to do, because the innate opposition opposes that. And somebody doesn't have to be motivated to do something. Those athletes are not motivated to go to the gym every day in off season, but they do because they have a plan, they have a system, and they know that that's what they need to do in order to do what's next. And somebody may not generate motivation until they actually set a goal and proceed toward it. So an action can generate its own motivation. So this is essentially to say motivation is not necessary, but a plan and sticking to it are. Those are the two things that a client will need, a plan and to stick to it. You're creating a new system in the model of a focus and a destination and creating a map to do it. That download is going to benefit that client when they're not talking to you. A simple example. You don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. You can simply set up an automatic payment plan to take X amount of money out of your checking account the first day of every month, putting it into a retirement account. It's one simple decision that can change your future. But you don't have to be motivated to do it every month. It's a one-and-done deal. 6, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals, especially dopamine and adrenaline, are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. It can even bypass your left prefrontal cortex when your emotional brain hijacks the whole left side of your brain. This is why self-talk can be limited. As soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. This is why you need a plan. One of the philosophers, one of the better philosophers of the 21st century, see how current this is, actually put it quite simply. Everybody has a plan till they get punched in the mouth. Of course, that was Mike Tyson. When there's a possibility of reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to anticipation of a reward. This is why a risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine, deciding you're about to spend in the mall or online, that releases dopamine. And it's not the act. So dopamine is not the reward chemical that we have come to believe over a long period of time. It's the anticipation chemical that keeps you going to look at possibility, to look at what's next. And this serves as a motivation. It's the anticipation of reward. When, for example, when gamblers were studied, they were hooked up to an fMRI. Their spike in dopamine occurred as they approached the slot machine before they ever touched it. And research shows that anticipation of reward is often more satisfying, even especially more exciting, than actually receiving it, because attaining the goal shuts down the chemical engine of anticipation and the high that goes with it. So this is why, paradoxically, some people are not as excited about something. They've anticipated for a long period of time. This is where buyer's remorse. You've anticipated something for a long time. You finally buy it, and then it's like there's a remorse. It's not what you expected because the neurochemical system instantly changes when you do it. It shifts from the anticipatory motivation of excitement to an entirely different neurochemical system after you do it. And it's not as exciting. It moves from the sprint system to the marathon system. And if it's misread, then it's like, well, you got to start all over again. This is where some addictive processes occur. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, known also as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of anticipatory excitement, short-term, enhance learning. Now, the time window here is important. It's a more limited time window, maybe up to a couple of hours. For longer periods of time, and in some studies, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines if there's a longer period that is sustained stress, and it's depleting. And from that state, people can make charged decisions or compromised decisions. So the most important success strategy for many of the executives and leaders I've worked with is regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. And secondly, how to have conversations with people instead of when someone walks in the room, you know, assuming the wisdom is at the front of the room instead of the wisdom is within the room, as we do with a client, and it's up to the leader or up to the coach to catalyze that process and create it and plan and shape it together. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. They become habituated to doing things in the same way. People who stay in one place in one position get most entrenched. This is where I see some resistance. In coaching, some of the more challenging is family succession of business. The founder of the business, the head of the family, passes the company founded 32 years ago to 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge. Everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and functions. That's a lot of brains. Change. That's a lot of change in a few brains that collectively all want to do the same thing, to take the same way instead of having to take a different way with construction. So now these last two principles I think are really huge for us as coaches. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. 2 things above all others creates neurogenesis, the making of new brain cells, an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment, if you think about it, intellectual, emotional stimulation, creates more complex brain structure to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to storybust, exactly what we do in our coaching with clients. The hippocampus is the part of the midbrain especially connected with creativity and memory. It's also the seat of the unconscious, which is where associations are connected. For those of you who want to tie this in with your readings and psychoanalysis, the hippocampus, creativity and memory. An example, mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells, creativity, stimulation at a mouse level. What's your guess about how much exercise creates increased number of cells in the hippocampus. Almost 100% increase. And this has been collaboratively found in non-invasive human subjects, beginning with London taxicab drivers who have to memorize all this stuff, and other forms of creativity, especially studied in University of Hamburg medical students. Another finding related, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. It decreases the number of cells in the hippocampus. Creativity and memory, the two functions of the hippocampus. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons, rezoning, developing cortical real estate. So what this means for us in coaching, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Here's a simple example. This is down the road a piece from me in Houston. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an exactly reversed image, upside down, consistently, 24 hours a day, their image was reversed. So they had to learn, and it took them gradual learning, to adjust everything they did. At first they had to think about it. Up was down was up. Then after getting a little bit better over time, then about day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. It rewired their brain. They didn't have to think about it or make adjustments anymore. The brain had developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them also 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. Now, notice the role of consistency. So this is what we're doing as coaches to help a client look at a focus, create a map for where they want to go for this session, create a system, because as we talked our first discussion, if you want to change, don't focus just on the goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. Focus on the system, the map. So our brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, we can call them mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and even predict the future. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, patterns become automatic, so we don't even have to think about them. The patterns become hardwired and automatic. Now, I want to end with a fairly brief discussion of how to map change. There are six elements, crucial elements, to map change, which is what we can think about with our clients. One, regulate states of mind. Since they're like software programs, a mind-body state determines how we perceive and how we process. So we want to have a grounded, centered state so that we have access to all of our states of mind, and that regulation can help determine what state works best for what task and optimizes learning. So this is a brain equation for good decisions. This is too simplistically put, but right brain emotional plus left brain logical intellectual equals a balanced decision. So we want to have that balanced, not overriding the emotion or with just the cognitive part, but a synthesis of that. The number two element to map change, the powers and the focus. This is what neuroscience and quantum physics have taught us and is behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have an energy of and a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects that frequency. You know, it's like all the channels of a satellite TV or a radio even are available. We choose the channel, the frequency we want out of hundreds of thousands of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. So this is where, if we want to change something in our life, we change and focus on the channel, our thoughts. If you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over. Focus on where you're going, not what you want to avoid when you go around sharp turns in life. This concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus is more effective than a problem focus. Problem focus goes down the same pathway, edges it even further. Solution focus creates new and exciting possibilities. To focus and have a framework, remember I talked about how excitement and anxiety are read by the brain in the same way? Brain can't tell the difference. When you frame it as excitement, as challenge, as opportunity, then you're creating a new framework and new pathways in engaging. That creates its own reward. So these brain connections, while they're being created, also become mind maps and then subsequently influence the reality that we see. So we put energy into what we want. We focus on possibilities instead of problems, desires instead of obstacles. To fight something is to engage it, to add energy to it. This creates resistance. But when you focus on what you want, what you don't want falls away, kind of like your lap when you get up to walk. 3, visualize changes. I'm not going to go into much detail on this because there's a component in the work pages of the outline. In one of the prototype studies in this, way back, basketball players at Ohio State were divided into 3 groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Another group, 30 minutes of regular practice daily for a month at free throws. A third group, they practiced imagining, visualizing, shooting perfect free throws, nothing but net, for at least 5 minutes for those 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. First group, no practice, no improvement. Second group, actual practice for 30 minutes, 24% improvement. The third group in that study, visualization only, had 23% improvement. Now, that was impressive at the time. Since then, we've learned more about how to visualize, and it significantly increases the success rate more than the actual practice, because each time you visualize, it's nothing but net, so you don't have to, you know, bang on the rim and then readjust, so to speak. So, create a vision, an image of your goal, then look back to see the path to get there as one possibility. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea, and the experience changes your brain. A vision can serve as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. 4, insight changes the brain. If you were to hook up someone two people, let's say, with an fMRI, and one person you gave facts, data, information, you wouldn't see any change on the fMRI. For the other person, you had an interaction that created a moment of insight, an aha moment. 3 different parts of the brain were light up, which would immediately vault them into a state of mind that's more synthetic and creative at that instant. And that is shown on an fMRI. So as important as an insight-induced change is, what we know in coaching is the sustained attention and planning systematically that hardwires it. So 5, take action. The world's not going to pay you for what you know. It'll pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan and set it into motion. Now, it may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep moving forward, learning from their mistakes, and produce results. This may be why a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kinds of degrees can plan and figure something out, but struggle to make it happen. Meanwhile, the guy who almost finished community college first year owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. 6, transform identity. This is what makes change permanent. A new experience or idea needs to be focused on consistently and frequently. When attention is constant, brain circuitry is stabilized, and when the change is incorporated as part of an evolving operating system, that affects identity. It becomes part of how and who you are. If you do something that is just a change of behavior, you do something different, if that's all you do, you're going to revert back to where you were before. If you systematically incorporate that as part of how and who you are, your needs, your ideals, part of who you are, that will make it permanent. That's what makes change permanent, is to transform identity, to make it a part of that transforming operating system. So, here, in very brief summary, some specific principles to help clients change mind, brain, and behavior. And I'm pretty sure this is in the outline. These are just some bullets of summary. Begin with a client, where the client is, what they want to focus on. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks, behaviors, patterns to incur. See what works. Look for the bright spots, the times in the past where something has worked, and see if that can help inform. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it needs to be on useful things, useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks, but look at where it works, where it doesn't. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Encourage the client to develop their own metaphors and connections, and do this collaboratively with them. Stories, analogies, metaphors are maps, become maps in themselves, and representatives of maps in the brain. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experience. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. And finally, give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. If there are questions, comments, or clarifications.
Hi, David. This is Danny Bedoni.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Happy Father's Day yesterday. I hope
you
had a wonderful time with your family.
I have a
comment on what you were saying with a music program called El Sistema in Venezuela. It was done in a very, very poor neighborhood with people that and children that had no money. And we put for 6 days a week, 4 hours a day, a system of being, of learning and doing the steps to have transferable skills through music. Every single child that was in that program, every single child went to school, excelled, went to college, never seen before. And now these music children are the conductor of the New York Philharmonic, conductor of San Diego, conductor, and these were coming from poor areas. We changed their brains by having a system 6 days a day, 6 days a week, 4 hours a day through music. So the brain does work, and you change a new story.
I know you've done some very innovative things in that area, in AI, and congratulations. That's a terrific example. Thank
Doug,
you.
I have a question.
Yes.
Hi, this is Lucy. We're sorry.
Okay.
Are there different notes than what the seminar notes? Because I'm finding that I'm not finding the notes that you're speaking of.
Okay, let me see if this helps. There's an outline to download and print, ideally. I am incorporating some of the questions and the things that I got as input. So I'm not exactly following the outline, but it's essentially there, and I'm not going to skip any major things. So it may be not exactly in the outline, but it will be all complete because it's the essence of the material. Does that help to explain it?
So where do I find the questions that people are asking that you're responding?
Those are just you don't find them. Those were I sent around. An email to ask, you know, what's the major thing you'd like to take away from this, and what's the major question you have about this topic? Those are the questions I ask. Those are informing me to try to incorporate that in the discussion, and that's shifting the outline some. But I didn't send those around, and I'm just preserving privacy.
Okay.
But I'm hopefully answering those questions in vivo as we discuss application and coaching instead of here's a question, here's the answer.
Okay.
Most of the time I have an answer, but I'll make it up as I go along, as you may have guessed by now. Does that answer your question?
It does. I was just looking for more of the scientific things that you're speaking of because I'm not finding those in any of the notes. So I was wanting to go back to when you go further into more of the scientific language.
Okay,
the
outline is just for reference for us for discussion and hopefully to bring it alive in a way that's applicable.
Okay.
And if you have questions or clarification, don't hesitate to send me an email. I know we're a couple of minutes over. Don't hesitate to send an email to clarify or if there's something else you want to add for our final discussion next Monday. And thank you all again for your responses and the collaborative shaping of this. I appreciate it, and I hope it's helpful to you. But let me know. So we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks again very, very much, and thanks, Danny, for mentioning your spectacular work. Thanks.
Thank you.